When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester.
The XS Manchester long player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.
You're right, I'm Jim, and this is the XS Long Player. Welcome if this is your first time. Here you will find conversations about classic albums with the people who helped make those albums. And tonight it is a band who were, just before the release of this 2007 album, dubbed Britain's next big band, which is something we get into a fair bit on today's podcast. I'm talking to Phil Etheridge from The Twang about their debut album, Love It When I Feel Like This. Today's conversation isn't just about the music. There's a fair bit on the hype around the band. There's a fair bit on the portrayal of The Twang in the press. But there is plenty on this classic album as well. Enjoy this conversation. I did. It's with Phil from The Twang. Another classic album boxed off on the XS Long Player. Oh, before we get into it as well, if you're a little bit sensitive to spicy language, then proceed with caution. Phil likes an F-bomb. Right, here we go. How you doing, Phil?
I'm very well.
Looking forward to talking about this one. We're going to start, as would seem sensible at the beginning, in the early days of the band. Now, yeah. Before all the members were kind of present and in place, you played guitar early days before you got the new members, and then you kind of gave up the guitar. You became kind of the front man, just did the vocals and whatnot.
Yeah, I played bass.
Oh, was it bass you played? Okay.
Bass on stage, yeah. Okay. Like, obviously, I played guitar when I was trying to write at home. But yeah, when we was playing live, I played bass, yeah.
So when you came, well, that probably answers my question in that case, because what I was going to say, when you came to kind of actually record this album, how did it feel in terms of kind of letting the others get on with the musical parts and you just concentrated on the writing and the recording and the vocals? Was there any emotion connected to playing bass? Were you like, oh, let me just do this bit?
Well, we'd done quite a bit of recording where I was playing bass.
Right.
And the only reason I kind of stopped is that there were certain tracks, like Cloudy Room, for instance, that I just couldn't get my head round playing and singing at the same time. So I used to like just pass the bass to John. We'd end up just doing it with no guitar or whatever. Certain songs were suffering for it. So that was the only reason we kind of swapped over. John was just a lot better as well, basically. But no, I didn't feel any kind of... I was quite happy. I found it quite stressful recording my B-lines in a studio because if I'm being completely honest, I just wasn't that technically good. I just used to pound it, you know, and have fun. But I missed it on stage for a little bit. You can kind of hide behind a guitar, yeah, you know, or a bass or whatever. And I used to like smashing it off the roof and kind of just like, yeah, I missed it on stage for a little bit. I didn't know what to do myself, but you work that out, don't you?
I don't think that's an uncommon thing, because you quite often see frontmen in bands holding guitars and doing very little with them, because it's a prop, isn't it? It's kind of like it's something to do. It makes you feel less awkward.
Yeah, I always think that. I did play guitar when we recorded Jewel Recorder 2009. The following tour to promote that record, I did play guitar on stage for that tour, but it just didn't feel... Maybe I'd done a couple of tours with it, actually, but I did feel like I was just standing there playing, splanging the odd chord, do you know what I mean? It didn't feel completely authentic.
I mean, going back to this time, going back to 2007, and The Twang were obviously a Midlands Birmingham band. At that period, and probably now, in fact, still it's the same, you don't often hear strong Midlands or strong Birmingham accents within music. It's not as represented as, say, Edinburgh or Glasgow or Manchester even, or even London. Did you feel like at that period you were doing something different, that you were singing with this authenticity that maybe other bands didn't have that were from your area?
I don't think I ever thought about the accent thing. You do what you do. Mm. I was conscious that a lot of bands that you see at that level when you're, you know, when you're unsigned and trying to do your thing, you know, we were conscious that a lot of bands seemed to copy whatever was doing well at the time, you know. So they'd all sound like Editors or some American bands. They'd kind of have that like Strokesy vibe to their vocal or whatever. And I thought I was always conscious that, you know, to just do our own thing. We did always feel that we were doing something different as well, because again, when we played with people, we were different. We weren't like your typical band lads. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I'm a bit gutted that I've got that word lads in early doors, because that's what everyone, you know, that whole lad rock thing was an annoying tag, you know, but we did feel different. We weren't as loud and raucous as our personalities. The music was quite calm early doors. It sounded different to how people would have expected we sounded, I reckon. Mm. It wasn't until Stu joined, our guitarist Stu, that, you know, we got a little bit more oomph to the sound. You know what I mean?
You've mentioned a lot of things there, Phil, that I want to go back to in a little bit. So, and we're going to talk more about the music itself on the album very shortly, but just want to pick up on what you said about this kind of lad rock vibe, because when the album came out, and probably in the run-up to the album, and when the singles were kind of coming out, the band were often portrayed as, and I'm not entirely sure what the right word is here, laddish is one, roguish, scallies maybe would be another. And there were loads of stories that kind of seemed to back up that attitude. There was the incident, the famous incident with the samurai sword, of course. Yeah. Was that a true portrayal? Were you kind of playing parts there, or was that how you see yourselves? Because when I listened to this album back, there's heart, there's intelligence, there's romance. And that wasn't always what came across when we read about you in the music press.
Well, I think the first person to get involved with the band was our press officer at the time. We had the same managers as editors. And the first story he run was the samurai sword. And I was like, fucking hell, why is he, why has he gone and done that? Because then every interview I was being asked about that. And before you know it, it had gone from what actually happened to like that we carry them in clubs and stuff. And it was just bizarre.
Obviously that story is an exception. I remember reading an NME review where they claimed you tried to spike them whilst they were doing the interview. Was that kind of a fair portrayal of the band at the time?
Well, I mean, yeah, we were no angels, you know, and it wasn't fake, but what was not true is that, you know, the hooligan thing wasn't true, because, you know, we weren't violent. We were just roguish, you know. We just had a little play up. We were just different, I think, as well. And the press they were crying out for that kind of, you know, the next Oasis, the next Mondays, and I think they still are. I think if you got, but then, you know, grime does that now, doesn't it? So you know, I guess they're always looking for that authenticity, that real band, you know.
Going back to what I said a second ago about the kind of the album and its part intelligence, romance, I think quite often when I've done this series of shows where we go back to classic albums, I've found something in the album that I didn't notice the first time round. And on this album, I think it was the kind of lyrical skill, almost an urban poetry, almost Sean Ryder-esque in terms of the way the songs are constructed. As the man behind those words, Phil, when was it you realised, or did you ever realise that you had this power with words?
So all the songs have always been written with myself and John Watkin. Mm. So I always, I've still got it where like, he's one of my favourite ever songwriters, John is really. And every time he wrote something, I was like, oh man, I've got to try and step up and write something as good, you know. So if he wrote an ice cream sundae, I'd try and write, you know, come down with a wide awake or whatever. And it was like, there was this constant, like, you know, he'd bring down a song, I'd bring down a song. And we kind of pushed each other on. Right. I don't think I ever thought I was talented in any way. I felt lucky that I'd met someone like John, that I had this relationship with a friend who wanted to do the same as me. And, you know, we had this like dream and ambition to go and do something. And rather than spend our time in the pub chatting bollocks, it was, you know, he wanted to go down the studio with me and, you know, and just write. And that's where we spent, you know, 3-4 nights a week and just, you know, trying to get the dream together, you know. And it was amazing times, man. They're the best times, I think, being in a band, you know, when things are coming together, when those songs click for the first time and that. I can picture being stood there, you know, the hairs stood up on the back of my neck and, you know, thinking that this is it, man. And that whole like dream of when we're signed, it's going to, you know, and it did happen for us. And it was like, yeah, man.
When it did happen, when you did get the record deal and it all started to move, there was a lot of buzz around the band. Going back to the NME again, they described you as Britain's next best new band. They said it was like the Streets remixing the Stone Roses. What does that kind of accolade do to a band, having that badge put you on? Does it feed the ego or does it just add extra pressure?
I've talked about this so much in the past, but I mean, at the time, honestly, I didn't realise it was happening, really. Mm. Or I kind of expected it a little bit. We did expect to get signed, and we did think, every time we played a show, we thought we were there and thereabouts. We never played with anyone that we thought was better than us or doing any, or we did feel that we had our own little thing and our own little clique. And it wasn't until, like, we played with bands like The Coral or James that we was like, this is where we're meant to be at, And that sounds probably really arrogant, but that's how it was. And I was conscious of that as well, because it's not possible to be the best band in Britain. Mm. Because if you're not into that kind of music, then we're the worst band in Britain. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, and looking back, obviously, it damaged us, because people want to dislike you. If no one likes being told, this is the band, this is the band you've got to like. It obviously is quite damaging. But at the time, we weren't bothered, because it was meaning the advance for the deal was just going up and up. It was happy days, really, The more they talked, the bigger the paycheck got. So it was like, it was pretty cool time, to be honest.
I think I've heard you say before that because of the hype around the band, and the album did phenomenally well, it was a top 10 album, you've got a gold disc from it and all that kind of stuff. But I think you've said before that the record label, because of the hype, were a little bit disappointed with how the album performed at the time.
I think it was a strange time. I think it was a number three album. If you'd have told me that a few years before that was going to happen to me, I'd have snapped your hand off. Yeah, it would have been nice to get a number one. But I think, the press fell off us a bit. Going back to that laddie thing, we didn't fuck up like they wanted us to. I didn't become a smackhead. I didn't end up in jail. I didn't start dating a supermodel. I didn't do the things that they'd have... A supermodel, what a wanky thing that is to say. But, I didn't start dating a model in London. I didn't move to London. I didn't do a lot of the things that I think... I didn't live up to it. And I did kind of back away from it a bit because, because of the way we were being portrayed, I did back away a little bit. I look back at it and it did kind of freak me out. And I did take a step back.
Was that conscious? Were you going, I'm not going to be the man you want me to be? Look, tabloid press.
I'm not like that. I mean, compared to most of those people writing it, then I definitely am. And most of my friends, are crackers. But I spent my time in a studio writing songs about my missus and stuff. It was like, I wasn't like that mad. Do you know what I mean? I used to perch on the end of my bed playing an acoustic guitar. I wasn't like some crazy fucker running around fighting people, A lot of the bands at the time, man, I never used to say stuff about other bands, but I was like, I hated it. I felt it was so fake. You had people walking out on stage in a little Stone Island jacket, giving it the big one, and that's not what they're about. I just backed away from it, really. I wasn't into it.
I'm not going to ask you to name any names, but instead we will talk about the album, some specific tracks off the album, if that's okay. And I'm going to ask you to pick a couple of highlights in a moment, whether they're your favourite tracks or stuff that brings back memories. It's completely up to you, but I just want to flag a couple up first, if that's okay. First, Either Way, I think we need to talk about highest charting single off the album, all over the radio, I seem to remember, back in the late noughties. What's your relationship like with that song now? Do you love it for the doors it opened, or do you hate it because it's the song that gets so much attention?
Very much so. I mean, that's the, I've said this a lot as well, but without sounding all X Factor, that is the song that changed everything for us. That changed our fortunes. That was what got management involved. That was what got the press officer involved. That was what got NME involved. It was the song that it just opened every door, We had so much interest in the band, and they were all basically just interested in that song. That's the song that, it just changed everything, And still, I think it means a lot to people. We get messages, on a daily about that track. When it does get played on the radio, it's an emotive tune, I remember, it was one of them that it took, they always say, it did take me 5 minutes to write and 6 months to finish. There's bits of that album. There's always regrets. I try not to have, I try and be positive about it because, to a lot of people, that record marks a time in their life and is important to them. But to me, obviously, that time, I look back and you'd always do things differently. But hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
The other track I want to talk about is track number 5 off the album, Push the Ghosts, which when I was looking at this, I noticed it had a writing credit for Ray Davies. Firstly, is it the Ray Davies, as in Ray Davies from the Kinks? Because I've never heard this before, and I can't find anything about it online. And it just piqued my interest, and I thought, I've got to find out more.
I've no idea. It's for that Salt and Pepper beeline, isn't it, that we had to, push it, Salt and Pepper?
Yeah.
We nicked the beeline, didn't we, for the middle eight? and they got like 50% of the track or whatever. So I'm guessing it's not the Ray Davies you're on about.
No, I don't think the Kinks had anything to do with Salt and Pepper Pusher, to my knowledge, but, anyway.
Unless they stole that beeline off him, I don't know. Who knows?
I'm going to go and do some further research and dig into that one. I'll find out. I'll report back.
I do know that we had to give, I think we might have even had to give, we definitely give 50% of that track away to them for that.
Pick me a couple of tracks that you love, Phil, or that bring back memories, or like you mentioned earlier, that you remember the hairs standing up in the back of your neck when you kind of wrote them or recorded them. Which specific tracks are they?
I mean, Two Lovers is another big one for us, you know. And that was, again, that was, I wrote that in my bedroom, perched on it. Saunders was living with me at the time, our old singer. And I went into his room and played it, this verse. And he just like sung the chorus like there and then. Like, you know, like those magic moments where you just spat the whole thing out in like literally there and then. And we were like, this is going to be great. And then that was one of the last tracks to be recorded as well. That was during the album sessions that we wrote that. Stu's guitar on that, it's like Smiths-esque. I love it.
There's a fair bit of Manchester in this album, isn't there? There's kind of, we've already mentioned Sean Ryder, mentioned the Stone Roses, you just mentioned the Smiths there. Was that kind of Manchester almost verging on the baggy scene a big influence behind this album?
Well, yeah, definitely. We all were like heavily into like rave and stuff when we were kids. You know, we were too young to be going to the, you know, the Fantasies and that. We all had the tapes and that's what we were into. And then, you know, 95, 96, we were all going to the Steering Wheel in Birmingham. And Decadence, and you know, was into like house basically. So it was always going to go that way once we picked up guitars. You know, once that Britpop thing happened in like late 90s, and everyone was picking up a guitar, we were just one of them. And once that happened, it was always going to go that way for us because of the influence of dance music. So, and it just so happens that Manchester's had some of the greatest ever bands. You know, you can't get away from even like bands like Woo Life and Money and bands that don't get talked about that much. It always seems I'm talking about bands from Manchester, but, you know, fair play to them.
Pick another track off this album that brings back memories.
One of the biggest memories is the fact that we ended up recording it in Wolverhampton in a blooming industrial estate when we could have been anywhere in the world, really. And I still look back at that and think, what the fuck were we thinking? You know, we could have been in blooming LA with Sardi or whatever, and we were in Wolverhampton with Gav. But again, that was trying to keep the authenticity of like, you know, he'd got us to that situation. So we stuck with him because I think a lot of bands have like demoed with him and then gone off, you know, you get signed and it's automatic that you go with Jim Abyss or automatic that, you know, you go off and do it with someone else. And we felt that we owed it to him to finish it with him. So, and it was January when we recorded it. It was freezing cold on an industrial estate in Wolverhampton. It was, so that's my biggest memory. But tune-wise, I love Reap What You Sow. I really like Reap What You Sow. I like it all. I think things like The Neighbour, Don't Wait Up, you know, I Can Take or Leave Now. But they were of a time. They were just observational stories of, you know, just what was happening in my life.
You're clearly really proud of this album as a whole, as a piece of work, and rightly so. I'm interested to know, because I know the early demos that you sent out, and when you first got your management, they were handing out these CDs with 25 odd songs on them. So obviously those 25 odd songs got whittled down to 11. I'm sure there were some new ones in the mix by the time you came to record it as well. When you look back on reflection of the 11 songs that are on there, do you kind of go, yeah, we made the right calls here, this is the right...
We had a nightmare. I mean, that's but you know, I can say that because I do feel that our B-sides were... But we were from that era of, you know, buying Oasis singles where you'd get three other classic tracks with it. So, you know, when we were putting out, you know, Amos With an Aim was the B-side to Wide Awake. That should have been on the album, really, you know. Saying Nothing was a B-side to Two Lovers. That should have been on the album. And one of the labels that wanted to sign us, that they wanted Saying Nothing as the first single. But we prided ourselves on good B-sides, you know. That sounds strange saying that nowadays, because it just doesn't matter anymore, does it? But we really, like, prided ourselves on it, and like we probably wasted a second album's worth of material on B-sides.
It's been fascinating talking to you about this album for the XS Long Player. Really appreciate your time. What is the status of the twang currently? I know you've been releasing albums pretty consistently since 2007. You've been playing your twangmas shows as well, your annual Christmas gig in Birmingham. is there any plans to kind of jacket in anytime soon?
No, I was in the studio last night writing, and I enjoy it. And as long as the fans are still turning up, we're still playing, you know, reasonable sized venues. And as long as we can still do that, we'll still get on the pirate ship and get out there and get amongst it. But I'm not one of them that's going to keep dropping down and you'll find me in a pub, you know, playing either way. I'm not going to do that. You know, I've promised myself that. But at the moment, you know, we're still selling out like main academies and stuff. So it's like, as long as that's happening, there's no reason to knock it on the head. I think we're up there with any band, you know. I think if you come to one of our shows, you'll see that it's chaos, man. There's real moments during the shows. And whilst that's still happening, and you know, there's no reason to knock it on the head. If I start feeling fake, if I'm stood there thinking, oh man, this is, then I'll definitely knock it on the head.
Phil, long may it continue. Hopefully we'll get a new Twang album and the live shows continue well into the future.
Man. You should come to the Ritz in Manchester in December.
I'll be there. Probably not down the front, but somewhere close to the bar.
All right, tap man. Cheers, mate.
Bye.
Take care.
The Excess Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
Excess Manchester.
Good that, wasn't it? Phil clearly very proud of this album, and rightly so. Brilliant album released in 2007. The Twang, love it when I feel like this. If you've not had a chance to listen back to the album, if it's been a while since you've gone through it from start to finish, I really recommend you do it. It's got some absolutely stunning songs on it. And lyrically, it is a brilliant album. Go and check it out. And hopefully you enjoyed today's podcast enough to explore more in the series. Loads of podcasts about loads of different classic albums. If you liked today's, if you liked this Twang and that period of music, I reckon other podcasts to check out in this series, you'd probably go for the one on Block Party, talking about Silent Alarm. Maybe The Music with Adam Nutter, that's a really good conversation. And you should probably check out The Wombats as well, A Guide to Love, Loss and Desperation. If none of them tickle your fancy, well, check out all the other shows, because there are loads of different albums discussed with a load of brilliant people. Go and find them on the podcast series. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review, leave us a rating, because it helps other people discover this podcast as well. Have a good one. I'll see you soon on the next Excess Long Player.
The Excess Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
Excess Manchester.